Welcome to the Shame-Free Zone with Veronica Monet, your friendly former sex worker and certified sexologist. The Shame-Free Zone is a safe place for your questions and your secrets about all things sexual.
Veronica Monet, your host for the Shame-Free Zone. And I have a very interesting guest tonight. He's actually a sex therapist. Now, one of the first questions I'm going to be asking him is just exactly what does a sex therapist do? Because I get asked this question all the time, even though I'm not a sex therapist, I'm a sexologist. And people always kind of confuse the two, and then they wonder if I actually have sex with my clients. And so we're going to find out just exactly what is a sex therapist and what do they do. And we're also going to be talking about why it is so difficult for couples, both young and old, to communicate about sex. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest. His name is Dr. John Biter, and he is, sex therapist. He's also got a doctorate in clinical psychology. And for those of you who wonder where he got his certification or credentials as a sex therapist, that comes from the American Association of Sex Educators, Counselors, and Therapists, or those of us who are in the sex biz, we just affectionately call it ASECT. So, Dr. John Biter, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Veronica, very clearly.
Well, welcome to the Shame Free Zone. I'm so happy to have you here. And, you know, one of the ways that I became familiar with your work is I actually took your test, an online test called the BSP. iTest, I think, .com?
Correct.
Yeah, what does BSP iTest stand for?
Well, it stands for Biter Sexuality Preference Indicator.
Sounds so academic. Can you help my listeners understand why they would want to take a test like that?
Well, I call it, rather than use the word test, although it's in the name of the website, it's a survey. It's a 90-question anonymous survey. It takes about 10 minutes to take. And basically, I developed this survey in response to couples that I was seeing in my private practice who were having difficulty communicating with their sexuality, and so they asked me if is there anything out there that could help them, and so that's why I developed it.
Okay. And what kind of results have you been getting about this?
Well, to date, I've had 5,000 people take the survey.
Oh, my God.
So my goal is, it might be a lofty goal, but I want to get 100,000 people worldwide. So I just wanted to know if they're, you know, does our Western culture view sexuality different than, say, European or any other, you know, countries around the world. But I'd say, like, the major finding right now has to deal with the men versus the women, and that I'm seeing men coagulating around one very specific set of preferences where the women tend to be more diverse.
Okay. That's interesting, because I just took this test with my ex-husband and I were still partners. And we've known each other for 27 years. You think you know what makes you tick, right? And we took your test, and it was kind of enlightening for us because we found out that we're both dominant, we're both adventuresome, and then we seem to diverge what I thought were gender-specific lines. Maybe you could help me interpret it, but basically, you know, I was more emotional, he was more physical, I responded more to fantasies, he responded more to touch.
Mm-hmm.
So does that sound like a kind of a boy-girl thing to you, or?
No. The imagination and the touch, that's kind of interesting, is that, you know, the way males get introduced into their sexuality, it's an impersonal, you know, a secret and a private affair, basically.
Okay.
And the women are certainly getting a totally different message, you know, from your side of the fence. Basically, you're getting introduced to sexuality as through a relationship. You know, the messages that you get are, you know, you should be in a committed relationship. You should plan on it used to be you should plan on marrying the person, but now I think they've just want you to be, you know, committed to somebody for a longer period of time. Where boys, when they're introduced in their sexuality, you know, it's basically they found dad's stash of Playboys or their buddy had a porno movie or something like that. And so they saw, you know, an image of a female naked that, you know, it's impersonal. They certainly don't know the person, usually.
Right.
And, you know, obviously it's a secret affair. You're not running around showing mom and dad, hey, look what I found, guess what I'm doing, type of a thing. Although it's implied that, you know, your parents know what's going on. You know, boys are encouraged to masturbate, and it hasn't been until recent that girls have even been given a little bit of a nod around that. So, you know, one of the things, if you're saying about gender specific, like, you know, you said that you were more about fantasy and he was more about touch. Well, a lot of his sexuality probably was initiated around fantasy. You know, most boys aren't having sexual experience as their first, you know, foray into that realm. So it's usually all about fantasy and just self-pleasuring. So
yeah, but I was the one who was into fantasy.
Pardon me? You were the one that was into fantasy. You said he was into touch?
Exactly.
Right, yeah. So that's why I'm saying it wouldn't be necessarily gender-specific, you know.
Huh, interesting. Well, so you shot holes through that theory. What should a couple do if they take your test? And by the way, for those of you who are listening, I've actually posted this on Facebook, and in just a second I'll make sure that it's up on Twitter as well. And if you are following me on Twitter, then you know where I am. If you don't, go to your own Twitter account, look for Veronica Monet. I think there's only like three of us out there, and I'm the one that's a certified sexologist. And I'm actually putting the your test online so people can take it.
Oh, thanks.
Now, let's say that, you know, a couple takes the test, and then, you know, lo and behold, they find out that they have these, they're not the same. Is that bad news or good news if they have different results?
I think it's encouraging that when you don't have the same result.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. Like, one of my earliest findings in my clinical practice is when, you know, I would have two couples, for example, they would come out the same, and they'd come out the same, let's say, on the first set of preferences with deals, what I call partner orientation, and that's dominant versus submissive. And I had couples that came out as both submissive, and, you know, one's looking at the other saying the same thing. They're basically saying, you know, this explains a lot to me. I've been waiting for you to initiate the activity. That way I know that you really desire and want me. And this is the husband saying it to the wife, and the wife,
right,
like looking at him saying, what are you talking about? I'm looking for the same thing from you. So in my, you know, that there's one reason why you definitely don't want to come out on top of each other. But it doesn't matter if you do. Like this one couple that did that, they learned how to negotiate then in the bedroom. They had matching nightstands, and so when it was his turn to initiate the sex, the candle holder was on his side of the bed. When it was her turn, it was on her side. So they just
interesting. What if two people are both dominant? How would you suggest those people navigate those differences?
Yeah, well, for dominant hasn't been a problem, but what I'd say is, like, I'm looking at dominant as the person who likes to initiate sexual activity. So
right.
And then the one thing that I don't share on the internet is how strong of a preference that particular category is. So there are so many questions out of that 90 that deal with dominant versus submissive. So you might not be all that dominant. It could have been one question away, and you could have been submissive. You could have, you know, tested out submissive. So, but if you're really kind of like over the top dominant, I think that's one of the things. Again, like, do you know that about your partner? Like, one of the things you said, how does a couple use this? Well, the first thing I tell people to do, before you take the test, if you're going to do it together, try to guess what you think the other person is going to be, and try to guess what you're going to come out at, and see if you can figure it out. I explain it on the website what the four sets of preferences are, so it's not real difficult to figure out. But just see how well you know it, and then, like you said, you know, there were still some surprises.
Right. So rather than necessarily be thinking that the differences or the similarities are a problem, just knowing this is like a piece of information about your partner and about yourself, maybe, that you don't know, things that you don't know. Because, frankly, I didn't know I was going to come out dominant, as in the one who wants to initiate. That really surprised me.
Uh-huh.
So what is that what you're saying? Is it basically this is not necessarily trying to find problems, but just give you more information so that you have more depth to your intimacy? Or
yeah, exactly. And it basically hopefully opens up the lines of communication so that you can talk to each other without feeling like threatened or judged, you know.
Yeah.
It just makes it a whole lot easier. Like, for example, like when you were saying about, like, I was testing out dominant, I was surprised by that. Did your ex-husband say, well, you know, I've seen that side of you?
You know, it was interesting. What he said basically was that he thought that we were going to come out with similar, like we were going to be very similar to each other and not
mm-hmm.
different.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that we've, you know, 50% we were the same, 50% we were not.
Right.
But, and for me, I guess I kind of had this preconceived notion that if one person's dominant, the other one needs to be submissive. So, you know, I was pretty sure he was dominant. So when I saw my test came up dominant, I was like, oh, my God, that doesn't work. So is that a fair analysis, or is that an inaccurate assumption?
No. I mean, I always say that there's never any right or wrong, but you raise an interesting point that I also wanted to you know, highlight, is the fact, and this is, again, another reason why I'm so interested in doing the research. I believe that in our culture, anyways, that women are typically kind of socialized to be the submissive partner in a sexual relationship.
Right.
And so I was curious to see, would most women, would the results show that most women were submissive, and it doesn't.
It doesn't.
So imagine that you're with your partner, and she's supposedly playing this role that society has prescribed for her, but yet she really does enjoy initiating the sexual activity. I mean, imagine having that conversation for the first time, like, you know, and I have had that happen. I've had a couple. You know, the husband just says, well, that clearly explains a lot to me. So, you know, it's like, you know, you finally, I almost want to say you're given permission now to, you know, kind of enjoy your sexuality the way you understand it.
Okay, so it's just because your test comes out one way doesn't necessarily even mean that you're expressing yourself that way. You might be hiding that part of yourself.
Exactly.
Well, I put something out on Facebook. I said, take the sex test. I did, and boy, was I surprised. And we've got a fan out there, Hercules Pleasure Coach, came back and said, so was I. So he's obviously one of the people who took your test. And like you said, you've had like 5,000 people so far?
Correct, yes.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
You passed statistically significant a long time ago.
Yeah, I'm not a statistician or a psychometrician, so I'm just gathering my data.
Well, so this must be a lot of a very difficult thing for you to quantify, though, with that many respondents.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to, I'm sure, to hire somebody to help me kind of sift through it, but I just kind of wanted to look at the overall results and start to, you know, see if I could understand some patterns. You know, some other things too, like when you if you're taking the survey with your partner, is you know, if they're willing to share as they complete the, you know, complete each of the questions, I think each one of those questions can be a source of discussion. Like there are some questions that I know people will never share with their partner for whatever reason, and then there's, you know, and it obviously depends on the relationship. and then there's those that really want to know, you know, about it. And like, for example, like lights on and lights off. Like, let me ask you this question, just based on, and I wrote that question specifically to look at self-esteem. So how do you think women would, you know, prefer lights on or lights off in the majority of people?
I guess that what, you know, when I was working as an escort, what I heard all the time was my wife insists that we turn the lights off.
Mm.
And that was a huge complaint. So that would be my assumption.
Yeah, and that's what the data is also proving, is that most women prefer the lights off, where most men prefer the lights on.
That is just, for me, it's just shocking. How are you going to show off all that fancy lingerie that I hope you have bought? With the lights off, you can't see.
Exactly.
Yeah, well.
Or learning to appreciate
women are,
their own body.
They always say a woman would rather be naked in a room full of men than naked in a room full of women, because women are incredibly critical.
Huh.
Yeah. Well, okay, so let's move on to this whole idea of, you know, people, couples in particular, having a hard time communicating about sex. You know, some of the questions that I put out there for our listeners were, why? Why is it so difficult for people to talk about sex with people that they are having sex with? And I'm wondering if you can shed some light on that for us and maybe also give us some tips on how we can make it easier.
Well, I, you know, again, from my clinical practice, I would say that the answer to this, one of the most popular answers, I'd say, or the most common answers, is the fact that they received so many sex-negative messages growing up. You know, that you don't talk about it, that it's dirty, that it's shameful, that, you know, again, you keep it very private. And, you know, a lot, I'd say, you know, there's expectations on men in particular to be kind of the keeper of all the sex secrets. At least that had been the way for a long time, and I still see that happening a lot, again, in practice. And that's not true, but we don't challenge these myths. And, you know, that, you know, if you have to talk about sex, then, you know, it ruins it. That there's another myth, too. Like, and I think that's one that's caused a huge amount of dissension. I think another reason that people don't talk about it is they're afraid of being judged. You know, what if, and I wonder how many couples have basically limited their ability in the sexual realm because they felt like if I really shared my fantasy with my partner, they would be totally freaked out, or they'd think that I'm really weird or strange or whatever, and so they just keep quiet.
You know, another one that I've encountered, because I teach these sex coaching classes to couples, and the couples actually come to my classes to learn communication skills in the first half of the class, and then the last half of the class they get naked and have sex with their partners. And I function pretty much as a coach, you know, teaching people technical, sexual technique, but a lot of it has really come down to I have seen tremendous efforts at people-pleasing. Both men and women are afraid to make, you know, a comment to tell their partner what they do or don't like because they're so afraid that their partner would be insulted or hurt.
Mm. Yeah.
Have you ever encountered that too?
Yeah, absolutely. So they'd rather say nothing. And where do we learn these messages? It's not like we pop out of mom's womb and we have all this information at our fingertips.
It's interesting you're talking about popping out of mom's womb, too, because I just wrote a preface for a book called Orgasms, Art, and Psyche. And I talk about in that book about how, you know, they have now established that male and female fetuses are masturbating in the womb before they're born. And a lot of people, you know, think that they've got to have pornography or they've got to have a fantasy about sex in order to derive any pleasure from masturbation. And I've actually been exploring the whole idea that, I mean, if your first orgasm was not associated with any knowledge of a sex act, I mean, that's an interesting thing, too, to me. You know, about what? How is it that our sexuality gets even attached to certain fantasies and thoughts?
Right. Yeah. That's a great question. I mean, there's been a lot of writers that have tried to, you know, understand how does the erotic mind get developed, when does it develop, and, you know. And one of the things, you know, in looking at fantasy and working with clients through some of their fantasies, I love that work. I just think it is so fascinating. To me, you know, working through sexual fantasies is very much like working through a person's dreams. You know, they're trying to make, you know, symbolic references, and a lot of times what they're trying to do is going from becoming a victim to the victor. A lot of times people's fantasies, you know, something that happened to them in their childhood that was really, you know, disturbing or traumatizing or whatever, where they were the victim and helpless and couldn't really, you know, whatever, a lot of times that becomes a really powerful, you know, motivator for, you know, a sexual fantasy and then a turn-on. But, you know,
it really does. And why do you suppose that's interesting, you know, because I've talked to a lot of women who feel really, really guilty about their rape fantasies.
Uh-huh.
So they feel like, well, I'm not empowered. So you're actually saying that by fantasizing about a situation that had originally victimized you and turning it into an erotic experience, you become more empowered?
Right. You become the victor. I mean, even women's rape fantasies, like if you know, just generally breaking those down, don't forget, in the fantasy, the woman is really still in control. You know, where she wasn't when it in real life, when it if it happened that way, you know,
right.
If that's what her experience was. But in the fantasy, she can control what happens to her, when it happens to her, and what the motive is of the other person.
Now, why do we suppose that becomes erotic?
Well, wow, that's a good question. I was going to tell you that, I mean, think about not answering the erotic part of it, but why would we want to even fantasize about that? And just think about how kids play, if you've ever seen children play. Like, that was when actually my very first client when I was going for my PhD, is I had a kid who wouldn't talk to me for over a year, and he did everything through play. And
wow.
So, you know, I learned how to interpret his play, but when you watch children play, they absolutely go from becoming the victims to the victor. And don't forget that, you know, how does that become eroticized? Well, think about, you know, becoming a victor, period. Isn't that a very pleasurable sensation?
Hmm.
And imagine if you wanted to magnify that sensation, what better way than to take it into the erotic realm?
Okay. But, you know, it's funny, you mentioned childhood, and it reminds me of when I was probably, oh, I don't know, 10, maybe, that some cousins came over to visit. They were in the same age group. I think we were like 8 and 10. And we were playing games that were suspiciously like sex games, but they weren't. They were actually reenactments of things we had seen on television or in movies. And it was all about tying each other up and threatening to you know, and at this point, a lot of us didn't even really know what we were talking about, let the man have his way with her.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure we even knew what that meant. But I can remember us getting really kind of, you know, all whipped up into a fury playing this game of pretending to tie each other up and pretending that we were going to get raped.
Mm-hmm. So how do you make sense of that?
It sounds to me very similar to what you were just talking about, is that, you know, you see something that's actually kind of scary and overwhelming in a film or on TV, and then the way that you make peace with that is to try to take control of it with your fantasy world or your play world.
Right.
I don't know, but you're the doctor. You tell me.
Well, you've mentioned about, like, you know, that extreme being scared and frightened. I mean, think about the people that have used the strangling technique around their you know, masturbation activities to the point of, obviously to the fatal point of killing themselves. But taking it, you know, you're taking kind of extreme things in your life and trying to derive the most pleasure from them. you know, there's this I sense of, like, you know, almost like, you know, not to compare this necessarily, but to somebody who's addicted to drugs and alcohol, they're always chasing that first high that got them, you know, to that place that they always want to go back to. And I think that sex can be very, very enticing in a very similar way, is that you, if you felt some intense arousal and orgasm, that you're always going to want to, you know, continually, you know, be in pursuit of that. Not always, but, you know, you definitely are going to want to seek that out. And so sometimes, you know, you feel like the only way you can get that is to go to extreme measures.
Yeah, of course, I was just talking about children playing in a backyard and wondering why children would be motivated to do that. But it certainly, you know, wasn't an addictive situation.
Right.
Just kids playing, and you know, kids do things like that. But, yes, I absolutely know the sex. Actually, I just wrote about sex addiction and how to tell the difference between that and sexual shame. I think there's, it's interesting because the whole idea of sex addiction was coined by a doctor now who, I went over to his website, and his name fails me. You may know who he is, but he has a test on his website where you can determine if you're a sex addict, and I found it to be just really neutral because you could, I took the test a couple of times and tried to skew it in the direction of somebody who is heavy into BDSM and porn, and maybe even seeing strippers and prostitutes, but it wasn't causing any problem with their life. And lo and behold, sure enough, the test came up a zero. So no sex addiction. So, but that's unusual. Most of the materials out there that I have encountered about sex addiction pretty much indict you as a sex addict if you pay for sex or see strippers or even enjoy porn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that word addiction. I think Patrick Carnes, I don't know if that's the site.
That's the one, yep.
Okay, yeah, he's kind of given the nod on that as far as sexual addiction. Having worked with drug and alcohol addiction, you know, through most of my postgraduate studies, I guess I see, you know, internet porn addiction or OSA, online sexual addiction, as more obsessive compulsive behaviors. I have a pretty strict definition personally around addiction.
Does that revolve around the body actually being physically addicted to a substance?
Yeah, and you basically can't get functioning without it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people that are, you know, that are typically addicted to porn aren't, I got to run out of bed and, you know, see somebody naked or chat with somebody immediately before I get my day started. I'm not saying that does it. It's usually not that extreme. You know, I've not seen that. I've seen more people who, you know, they get on late at night and they can't get off and they're ending up staying up all night. And then they're, you know, not going to work. And then the consequences, or they're looking at porn while they're at work and those types of things. And, yeah, the social consequences. But, again, I see it more of obsessive-compulsive behavior as, quote, an addiction.
Well, yes, and I've read those arguments as well. And I guess to me, whether you call it obsessive-compulsive or addiction, if, you know, as one of my clients masturbated, you know, on the job and was not able to stop, and he lost like 3 jobs in a row from masturbating to porn at work. Whether you call that obsessive compulsive or an addiction, it's highly dysfunctional and disruptive of his lifestyle.
Right.
So, and I guess that's the important part to me, is like this isn't working.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I mean, there's some behaviors that people have lots of, you know, severe judgments about, like maybe BDSM. You know, and I'd even sort out, you made a reference to autoasphyxiation. It's, I think, an incredibly dangerous sexual practice, and I personally, you know, would not help anybody do it. I wouldn't do it myself, and wouldn't teach anybody about how to do it. However, I'm not so sure that I would be quick to call that obsessive behavior or an addictive behavior. Could be that it is, and I see where your point being that you need ever increasing highs so that, you know, this no longer works. And so then you have to go do something that puts your life at risk, and you become, you know, more and more dangerous and more cavalier. But I don't know. I mean, I guess I always thought that obsessive behavior is repetitive. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Again, the cases that I see are typically about that. So.
About repetitive behaviors.
Yeah.
Yeah. I work with sex addicts, and one of the things that I get so frustrated because, you know, somebody like Tiger Woods steps out of the, what is considered an acceptable behavior because he's cheating on his wife and he's had sex with, I don't know, you know, 20 beautiful women. And is it causing problems for him? On one hand, yes, because he lost his sponsors. But there's a lot of people who aren't in Tiger Woods' position who don't have sponsors and aren't trying to pretend to be the all-American sports hero, who would just consider that to be living it up and having a good time. And I, you know, when sex addicts, as I know them, are not having a good time. They are, you know, so chained to their addiction or compulsion, however you want to term that, that it's taken the joy out of life in general.
Right.
Has that been your experience, or?
Yeah, it's not about that pursuit of pleasure. There's always some underlying issue, you know. In any kind of addiction, there's always an underlying issue. There's never just an addiction and that's all there is to it, you know.
Right, because usually it's an avoidance pattern. You are
right.
Actively trying to avoid having a memory or an emotion, wouldn't you think?
Exactly, yeah. You've been traumatized, so there's some underlying other condition that I call it some other underlying serious emotional wound that hasn't had a chance to heal, and this is one of the ways you're doing that you're using it to self-medicate, thinking that it'll help take that pain away.
Right. Well, you had previously when you and I emailed each other, you had talked about that you were very passionate about educating people away from a performance-based sexuality to a pleasure-based one. And this might be a good time, we're about halfway through the program, for us to segue into that. And you know, because, you know, there may be some people out there who are suffering from obsessions or addictions around sexuality, and I'm sure we're going to give them some contact information so they can contact you for more information about that if they want. But I would imagine the greater percentage of our listeners are probably doing what I find most people do anyway, which is worry, is my sex life normal? Am I good enough? Am I doing it right? And it's like, and that is very performance-oriented. It's a real contest out there. So how can you help people actually have more enjoyment of their sex life and stop worrying so much? What would you like to share with our listeners tonight?
Well, the first thing I wrote an article based on comparing our sex drive to our appetite for food, as you know, our hunger drive, okay?
Okay.
And is there, think about, I mean, there's so many ways to take this up, but I guess the first thing I'd say, like, to enjoy your sex life more, you've got to learn how to change your perspective and your attitude. If you can allow yourself those two shifts, and easier said than done, I'm sure. But if you think about, like, food, like, how many choice, like, if you want to go out and eat tonight, like, what choices do you have? Well, you can stay in and you can have whatever you had last night, leftovers or whatever. You can go out, you could get, you know, take out, you could eat formally, you could eat fast food, you could have pizza, you could, you know, and the list goes on and on and on. Okay, a lot of choices, right? And there's not a problem if one of you wants, you know, say one of you wants to have, you know, a hamburger and one of you wants to have Chinese. That's not a problem, right?
Right.
But when we shift it over into the sexual realm, because look at the performance, because most people, that's one of the very first questions I'll ask somebody, how do you define sex? And I'd say the majority of people say, well, it's obviously it's intercourse. And then that to me is like, you've just narrowed it down. You've narrowed your food choices down to having leftovers served by the same person that you had the night before, the night before, the night before. You know, kind of tongue-in-cheek about that. I meant to be facetious with it, but you don't give yourself the same variety of choices sexually that you do when you eat, you know.
It's a really good point, and I often, you know, I don't think it's a real mystery how we got focused on that as being sex, because it seems that if it's procreative, you know, a procreative sex act becomes the definition of sex. And if you're not doing a procreative sex act, then it's not really sex. So that we get to the point, you know, where Bill Clinton says, I didn't have sex with that woman, and then we find out that he actually did have oral sex with Monica Lewinsky, and then we wind up with a whole generation of junior high kids who wind up with gonorrhea of the throat because they don't think they got to use a condom for oral sex because it's not sex.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that would be just like one repercussion, but... It pains me to see couples, you know, who may have some health issues, and whatever those health issues are, where, you know, sexual intercourse may not exactly be working for them, and they could find pleasure in so many other ways, tantra, you know, oral sex, you know, BDSM, role playing, whatever. There's just, like you said, this huge cornucopia of a feast out there sexually, and yet because their penis isn't as erect as they want it to be, or they're not as wet as they want to be, that becomes the whole focus. And I think, what a waste of energy. I mean, if you're past the years of actually making children, why is this such a concern?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look through throughout our culture and society, I mean, and it's just not ours, there's many others as well, but we are so performance-focused. Look at, I don't want to name any of them, but I mean, look at the erectile drug advertisements. Listen to the ED advertisements the next time. You will never hear anything about relationship whatsoever. It'll basically say, be ready when the time is right. Time is right for what? You know, basically what you do is you limit your ability or your availability and ability to have sex with your partner if you define it so narrowly as intercourse and performance. I mean, religions have basically, again, around the procreation that you mentioned, they were all about that, so of course you were having that feed into it as well.
Oh, it absolutely is, and I hope that at some point the human race can stop being so superstitious, because if we don't stop being superstitious, I don't have a lot of hope that we aren't just going to overpopulate ourselves right off this planet, or at least into some kind of a famine, or, you know, where we're going to be fighting over drinking water. Because, and that's another reason that I would love to see people actually start, you know, enlightening themselves about non-procreative forms of sex, because the planet could really use that, and, you know, the quality of human life, I think, would benefit, because I think, you know, the population has doubled since I was born in 1960. It's doubled since then, and, of course, it's going to double a lot sooner than 50 years the next time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, to me, that's really frightening.
Yeah.
We got a couple of comments here over here on Facebook. I put out rape fantasies. Are they okay, normal, a sign of low self-esteem, or a way for the victim to become the victor? We got a comment from Tristan Dean. He says, wow, I don't believe there's a single right answer to that question. And then Ray Sawhill says, people can fantasize about whatever they want to fantasize about, so long as their actual behavior is acceptable, in my humble opinion. And, of course, you're the doctor, so I'm going to come back and ask you to settle this question here. Would you say rape fantasies were a healthy way for the victim to rewrite a victimizing script, or would you say it was a perpetuation of trauma?
No, I would say that's exactly what we use fantasy for, is to, you can use fantasy to heal a wound. So, yeah, absolutely, when you're taking yourself from becoming the victim to the victor. Some people can't actually go back to that. Those are the people who get re-traumatized if they would be kind of, you know, forced, not physically, but, you know, just to have somebody say, oh, well, you should use try to use that fantasy to overcome your trauma, then that's when it would become damaging. But not when it's, again, you're now the one in control. So, no, absolutely not. You can use it to heal.
Hmm. Well, I'm sure that's going to be of comfort to a lot of people that are listening and will be listening to this program when it hits the archives as well. Because I don't know about in your experience, but I've mostly found that men don't seem to agonize much about what they fantasize about. It's kind of like, well, that's what turns me on. Mm-hmm. But with women, I find they seem to be very concerned about what they fantasize about and why and what does it mean. Would you say that's a fair assessment, or have you had a completely different experience?
No, I'd say that's. I would say, though, that I also see a lot of guys who are afraid to tell their partners or their wives what their fantasies are, especially if their partner or wife is not in the fantasy.
Right.
So that's a huge problem for a lot of couples. And again, I challenge people, like, where did you learn that that's the way it's supposed to be?
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, what would you say to men who are, you know, I'm sure you're aware this is a couple trends. One, we've got older men who are losing their erectile functioning, and they're turning to Viagra and Cialis and things like that to try to get an erection. And then there's a trend with younger men who are also turning to things like Cialis and Viagra in order to, because it kind of goes to the school of if this much is good, then more would be better. So I may be 20 years old and have a rock-hard penis, but it could never be hard enough. And that would definitely be a performance-oriented take on sexuality. So if you were speaking to people who felt like they can never be big enough or they can never be hard enough, and you're trying to help them to become more pleasure-based and less performance-based, what might you say to them?
Well, I have a real, not an issue with it, but a real concern about younger people using those ED drugs. A lot of times,
define younger. Are they under 35?
Yeah, I would say like in their 20s, you know, using it because they were too nervous with, you know, they're looking to get, quote, laid every night by a different girl, and they're actually not able to do it without the help of the drug because, you know, they don't want to have to deal with their own feelings, so they're trying to negate them and use the drug to get around them. So that's kind of really scary to me that's what you're doing. You're kind of, again, you're conditioning our males condition ourselves away from our feelings, which is, you know, we don't listen to our bodies. You know.
Right. So what you're saying is that this young man is probably feeling fear and trepidation around the sex act, and what he's trying to do is pretend that he's just a performance machine and he doesn't have any emotions.
Exactly. And that's the message that we keep sending out to our males. And I think that's such a damaging message. And if there was one thing that I would love to say at the end of my career is that I helped change that whole way of thinking, that we started educating our children, not just our males, that, you know, that our sexuality is a good thing, and it's very natural, and it can be teaching them responsibility and ways to share in pleasure, like, and start to make, you know, a sexual interlude with somebody based on fun, intimacy, and affection, as opposed to performance. And we might not have as many teenage pregnancies as a result of that.
True. And, you know, speaking of teenage pregnancies, how did you feel about Dr. Laura Berman when last year she was on the Oprah Winfrey Show and she recommended that mothers buy their daughters vibrators?
Well, I mean, it's obviously encouraging, you know, their daughters to masturbate. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that that's a bad thing. I'm sure that she got a lot of flack for it, though, right?
I think she did. I think she did, but I thought it was really a brave move because, you know, masturbation has been so taboo, and I think it's kind of hilarious, really, because, you know, a lot of the people who are against masturbation are sitting at church pregnant, unaware of the fact that the life inside them may actually be masturbating during church services. And I that gets a chuckle for me. You thought you were going to teach your child not to masturbate. It's too late.
Yeah, right.
They got around to it before they were born. And obviously that says a lot about how sexuality is at our core. If it's what you do before you have your first breath of air and your first sip of mother's milk. But the idea that a daughter could pleasure herself so that she wouldn't feel all her hormones so raging and out of control that she's going to endanger her health or her college career with, you know, one night in the backseat of a car. I think, you know, if you're looking at harm reduction, there's a lot to recommend it.
Right. Plus the fact that she starts to get, you know, familiar with her own body and what pleases and pleasures her so that when she is with someone, she can help them.
Right.
Because
right.
Leaving men with the... I think that's still just still remains a bad philosophy that the men are the keeper of the sexual secrets.
Yeah.
Men are the keeper of the sexual myth and, you know, kind of educate the women that if you're going to be a real woman, this is how you have to perform. You know, based on, you know, again, faulty logic and all the other stuff that he's been exposed to.
And isn't that the trend now, where girls kind of feel like they have got to be bisexual or at least bi-curious in order to be an interesting girl? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they've got to be able to perform a good, you know, blow job. It's interesting to me. And then pole dancing. They got to be a stripper too.
Yeah.
And they got to dress like a porn star. I think it's sad because I still don't see the empowerment and the choice. I don't see the young women saying this is about my body, my pleasure, and you know what turns me on. It still seems focused on what turns him on.
Right.
Yeah. Well, look, we've got just a few more minutes. So what is it that you'd like to tell our listeners about opening up the channels of communication and getting away from performance anxiety in the context of, you know, dating and marriage? What kind of tips could you offer them?
Well, one of the things I'd say, you know, that I think would be very helpful to couples and actually just in single people too, is not to try to get away from that performance and start to concentrate on arousal. What gets you aroused? And how can you expand what arouses you? And how can you share that, what you know about yourself, and how can you experiment with your partner to just increase arousal? What if instead of, you know, tonight I've got to make sure that I have this rock hard erection, you know, and she has to have an orgasm as well? Why don't we see how aroused we can get? And why don't you challenge yourself that way? I mean, I must say, like, you know, for those that can become, you know, anal about it, then put a number on it and say, okay, we're going to shoot for 5 on the arousal scale today. How can we get aroused? And what would it take for you to get aroused as a couple as opposed to, you know, the performance aspect of it? I mean, think about it. Everything leading up into the I've heard so many people say that everything leading up to the orgasm is really what makes for a memorable experience. The orgasm you'll have time and time again, and that's basically forgotten, but not what led up to it. So whatever you can do to enhance that, and that could come through, you know, talking about, look at some of the questions that I have. There are fantasy questions in there. Explore them. Explore other things that have been written by other people. You know, but don't limit yourself at all.
So, well, that's, you know, I think that's really wise advice. So, but what about the fear of actually having the conversation? I mean, this seems to be a big thing that's holding people back. What can they do to just even get brave enough to talk about not being performance oriented?
I think it begs the question, have you ever had a discussion, you know, either in the bedroom or outside? And some couples absolutely are going to say yes to this, but about, you know, what pleases you. Have you shared your sexual, I'm not saying to share all the details of your past, but have you felt comfortable enough and close enough to your partner to share the more intimate details of your sexual life? And if you haven't, then maybe that's not the place to start. You know, you've got to ask yourself, if I'm not willing to share that with my partner, what's preventing me from doing that? Is it that I feel like they're going to judge me? Well, then maybe that's where you start your conversation. You know, I'd really like to talk to you about some things, but I always feel like if I bring this up, I'm going to feel judged in the end, and so I'm reluctant. I mean, just kind of learning how to be honest with your own feelings. And I think if you're looking at, you know, that fun intimacy and affection being your goal for sexuality, well, intimate part of it can come through just being honest with how we feel about one another. And there are ways to discuss this without the other person needing to feel like they have to get defensive. And I say it's a simple strategy. It's just learning how to use the I statement and not the you statement. I feel this way. This is what I think when this happens. Rather than, you know, when you do this and you said this and you did that, well, then that obviously puts the person right on the defensive. So learning how to keep it on yourself, but maybe start out small and share your feelings with them. Then maybe share that I'm really uncomfortable talking about this, because they may feel the same way and are afraid to voice it.
I think that's very good. We've got another comment here from one of our listeners, Will McGowan. Says, our imaginations are okay, but acting on impulse sometimes hurts other people. So I don't know. Do you have any comments about that comment?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good point. And that's one of the things that I can tell you, like, that a lot of, this is why I've heard why some people don't want to share their fantasies with their partners, is because their partner will automatically think that this is what they want to do. And, you know, the reason that fantasy works so well in your mind is because you control every aspect of everything that's going on. When you try to basically push fantasy into reality, then there's a whole bunch of unknown variables that come into play. So,
yeah.
You know, you should be very, you know, very thoughtful and cautious about really wanting to act on you know, your imagination, and make sure that it's a consensual thing and that the other
absolutely
people
don't. I've lived out most of my fantasies, and I'm, you know, I could say that for me personally, really glad that I did. It's been a lot of fun, but there are some things where acting it out, actually doing it, kind of ruined it as a fantasy. Say, okay, well, it's not like it was a bad experience, but it just wasn't as hot as thinking about it being a hot experience.
Now, your listeners are going to want to know, give us an example.
Well, I could say this. Going to a brothel, a legal brothel in Nevada with my husband, was a fantasy that I had, and it was actually better than the fantasy. So I really had a lot of fun doing that. But I went to an orgy one time, and there was like six of us in the room having group sex, and that was not hot for me because I find it too distracting to have that many people touching you at the same time.
Okay.
You didn't think I was going to cough that up, did you? This is the shame-free zone. Don't dare me.
That's right.
Well, look, we are about out of time. We've got just a couple more minutes here. Tell the listeners a little bit about you, your services, how they can find you, how they can contact you.
Okay. Well, you had said at the beginning of the program, what is a sex therapist? So maybe I should talk a little bit about that. But
oh, yeah.
You know,
we totally got away from that, didn't we?
Yeah, it's okay.
We got 2 minutes. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I've heard a lot of people have these really fantasized ideals about what I do, so I really don't want to ruin it for them. But it's never what you think it is. But it's people that basically are having sexual dysfunctional problems in their relationships or with themselves, and that's what they come to talk to a sex therapist about. They want to work through it. A lot of times I'm just educating people, helping them challenge the myths. You know, there's a lot of resources that I point people towards. There's a lot of things, obviously, that I've read in my studies, and so there's a lot that I have to share with people there. But people basically want somebody that they can talk to, feel comfortable with, not be judged by them, and you basically work through some of their issues. So,
right, and you're not, you keep your clothes on and you're not touching your clients.
Oh, right, yeah. I have to follow the American Psychological Association ethical guidelines, so I would lose my license if I did any of that. So
I don't have a license then. When I teach my sex coaching classes and the couples are actually having sex in the room and I'm there, mm-hmm. I can't touch them either.
Right.
Because I charged them for the class.
Okay. Yeah. You have a position of authority there, so sure.
Well, I have a position of authority, and also if you charge somebody and then touch them sexually, I think they call that prostitution.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be
it. Last time I checked. So you are certified through a lot of different organizations and licensed and very legitimate, and would you say that your clientele is mostly men, mostly women, or equally divided?
Yeah, I'd say that 75% of the clients that I see are men.
Right.
I think a lot more men feel comfortable talking to a man about those types of issues.
Well, I just think men feel more comfortable talking about sex, period. I mean, I'm a woman. I'm on Facebook right now, and the only people who responded were men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's really interesting on my survey of the 5,000, 60% of them have been men. Men have always been, you know, kind of leading the charge on who's taken my survey.
And that's something.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, we got to get the women so they're not so afraid of that word sex, and that's what I've been trying to do for the last 20 years, is go out there and say, don't be afraid of those stigmas and those labels, because, you know, it's smoke. I mean, there's actually have been, you know, some real repercussions, but if we don't take those chances and start changing the culture so that women can be sexual beings, you know,
mm-hmm.
never going to be whole.
Right. Exactly.
And your website? Let's send them over there again.
Okay, it's www.bspitest.com, and again, that BSPI stands for Biter Sexuality Preference Indicator. So, and again, it's a 90-question forced choice survey. It takes 10 minutes to take, and you'll get a nice little profile at the end based on your results.
And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun and very informative. Thank you so much for joining us in the Shame Free Zone. And I'm sure I'm going to get even more Facebook comments after we hang up here. I wish I had been able to get them on a couple hours earlier, but oh well.
Well, Veronica, I really appreciate the opportunity, so thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Keep doing your great work. I love what you're putting out there.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right. Good night.
Okay. Good night.
Thank you for tuning in tonight. If you liked what you heard and you want more solutions for your love life, please call me toll-free at 888-903-0050. Once again, that number is 888-903-0050. I am the only person who answers that line, and I am usually available Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific Time. You can also visit sexwithoutshame.com to discover more of what I can do for you. And remember, your secret is safe with you. Yeah.